Hello and welcome to the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. I'm your host, Robert Crichton, General Overseer of the Beyond Shakespeare podcast, which specialises in creating full cast audio adaptations of drama from before 1642, as well as providing background and other production resources. You can support our work and get a say into what we produce by becoming a patron today. Go to www.patreon.com/Beyond Shakespeare. Today I'm talking with
Greg Walker, Professor of English at the University of Edinburgh. I have published lots of books on early drama.
About John Heywood, playwright at the court of Henry VIII, Edward VI, Mary I. He was around for quite a long time. Who we have been recording for the better part of a year now. We have almost completed every single play John Heywood wrote, what has survived. And this is part of our follow-up work. This is part one of a two-part interview. This first part is mostly about John Heywood's early life, which is his playwriting career, as far as we're concerned, up to the early 1530s, and we'll discuss his plays in some detail. And for the first time on this podcast, but not for the last time, not only can we discuss these plays in detail, I can demonstrate what we're discussing with audio. Every play we discuss is available online now. The first six plays are on the podcast, and Heywood's final surviving play, The Play of the Weather, will be released by us soon. But if you're in a hurry to catch up with it straight away, you can watch a staging which was created a few years ago, which Greg Walker was involved with. The details are in the show notes, and you can follow the link. Part two of this discussion, where Professor Greg Walker talks about Heywood's later career and life and a bit more on The Play of the Weather, which we only touch on here, will be released soon alongside our production of The Play of the Weather, which is in the edit. The following discussion was recorded last year, and my enthusiasm to talk about Heywood runneth over. So whilst we do move in a generally forward direction through his life, we do dance around the plays a fair amount. I had fun. Enjoy. Right, so let's start with, because you're working on a book about John Heywood at the moment, I believe.
I might optimistically say I've just finished it, but as with all these things, I suspect there's another edit and maybe another edit after that to go. But technically, there's an introduction and there's a conclusion, and we go from the introduction to the conclusion without obvious break. So.
Right, well, in that case,
250,000 words on John Heywood.
Ooh, fantastic.
Which strikes me as too many, but
well,
I just couldn't stop.
Well, I can entirely understand that. Starting, shall we say, the early part, who was John Heywood and when was he born? Or more importantly, where was he born?
Ah, well, good questions. I knew you would ask me technical things because at my age, memory escapes me completely. So I wrote down 1497, which is a guess, but in... Now, my maths will escape me. Now, is it 1572? He wrote to Lord Burleigh claiming to be 76? Something like that.
Mm.
So there's only one estimate, and it's his own. So we assume he was born around the last 3 years of before the 15th century. Probably in Coventry, although we're not sure about that either.
Well, it's one of those fun things, looking in the collected works, the introduction, born Coventry or London?
Yes.
And going, well, they're right next door to each other, you know.
One on the other. It's a good rail line in the late 15th century.
Absolutely,
so
absolutely. Probably better than now. So why do people think Coventry? And what evidence do we have for his origins?
Well, his father was from Coventry. We know that. And also John Rastall and the whole Rastall family into which he married were Coventry people. And Thomas More had links to Coventry. And so far as we know, he must have been living with his parents in Coventry at the time of their birth. That's fairly obvious. But I mean, for the first few years after that, it's, you know, with people in this period, it's only when they become interesting or by some quirk of luck that you get early records. So we know when most interesting people died, but we don't know when they were born or where they were born until they become interesting enough to have a salary check or something from the court. So it looks very much as if he moved from Coventry to London sometime in the first decade of the 15th century, probably as a chorister somewhere, although there isn't much record. And he may have been at court, before the first record of his arrival, which is in the very late 1510s, early 1520s. I mean, having been born in Coventry, I can probably say this myself. It's not as interesting now as it was then. I mean, Coventry was the third biggest urban centre in England in the late, well, in the 14th century. And had a very thriving musical and religious culture. So if we're looking for reasons why a young boy might turn to singing and musicianship in this period, living in Coventry is probably a very good sort of prompt to look for a career in that area, particularly if your relatives are also interested in spectacle and the organisation of music and drama. And Coventry had a very thriving religious cycle play like York and Chester, yes. Although not much of it has survived.
Yes, we've got two solid chunks and that's a think about it. So what would assuming that his career starts off primarily music-based, what sort of life would that have been? How do we think that career progressed?
Presumably in a choir school to start with, although we don't know where. Maybe in the royal household, although there are no records. And in a way, I guess it depends on who he worked with. I mean, you get horror stories of choristers having a hard life, being beaten by choir masters and abused in all kinds of ways, and others who clearly thrived on it and prospered and had benevolent backing. So we don't really know what Heywood's early life was like, although as a teacher himself later, he was clearly much loved and benevolent, and no one complains about his physically beating them or anything if they got their notes wrong. So I'm inclined to think he had a happy start. Quite a rough life for choir boys, I think, in general. I mean, they got up early, they learned their lessons. The choir boys at St. Paul's were renowned for causing mayhem during services because they had this thing called spur money, which they were allowed to collect. If anyone entered St. Paul's Cathedral wearing spurs, a choir boy could accost him and get a penny, I think. So, you know, in the middle of a choral interlude, one of them would run off and grab someone and there'd be chaos. So, I mean, I think it was a fairly rough life. I don't think it would have been, you know, a life of contemplation and aesthetic art, which again would, I think, serve him well in later years when his sense of art is a very pragmatic one. And, yes, you know, the plays are full of moments of sort of both high drama and kind of low coarseness and dancing and jumping about and cutting from one theme to another in a way that suggests he didn't take, you know, the muse too seriously.
It's like, yes, you've run with an idea for long enough. Now let's jerk the audience awake with some action that's very interesting. It seems to me that he sort of learns to do that more and more as he goes on, that actually he gets a sense of how the drama functions through. It's sort of that frustrating thing that we have only got the very earliest chunk of his dramatic career. You know, we can see him emerging as an artist and growing to really quite, I mean, that's definitely my feeling with having hit Play of Love and Play of the Weather, that he's really hit his stride. And then we don't have anything.
No, although, I mean, what we do have suggests it was probably much the same. I mean, the description of the parts of man, the play that he performed for Thomas Cranmer, sounds very like the kind of dynamic and the structure of some of those early plays, like 4P or the Play of Love. You know, you have a debate on a big theme, enlivened with exciting moments of kind of physical theatre and jest. And then you come to a conclusion, which is that things are pretty much as you thought they were.
Yes.
And if you mess around with them too much, you're going to end up much worse off. So careful what you wish for.
So he's arriving in court as presumably a singer, a musician. How does he progress to drama, do we think, or theatrical performance in the way that we get? And considering the people who he's probably interacting with, Rastall, Moore, etc., how does this melting pot come together?
Well, I mean, that's, in a way, the 6 million groat question, isn't it? I mean, his early records are as a singing man and then a player of the virginals, the keyboards. And throughout his life, that's how he described himself. I mean, he doesn't talk about himself as Heywood the playwright ever. So in his own head, I think, you know, he was part of a kind of, you know, he was invested in an entertainment that was primarily musically based, but clearly allowed him to write plays and perform in them and act as a producer and sort of actor manager in some ways. So, and it probably happened in quite late in the 1520s, I think. It's difficult to put the bits and pieces together because, you know, we just don't have the evidence. But John Rastall had built a stage, which is a fairly ambitious thing to do, in his new house at Finsbury Fields, just north of the city of London, sometime in the mid-1520s, just after Heywood had married Joan Rastell, John's daughter, and was clearly part of the family and would have been in that circle. So, I mean, one obvious guess is that they had to fill the repertoire of that theatre. And so, you know, they all worked together. So my sense is that probably Gentleness and Nobility is a collaboration of some kind between Rastell and Heywood, although quite who did what and how.
Well,
is up for grabs.
We have many theories in house.
Go on. Yes.
Well, it's interesting that you've got these first plays where there's primarily three actors in those first few plays, and it's just that feeling that he's grabbed someone and pulled something together, and it's that feeling that one of them's Rastell, one of them's someone else, because those first plays, the Gentleness and Nobility technically has a fourth speaker, but you can almost dismiss them as a meaningful part of the dramaturgy. But having done Witty and Witless, we did them sort of out of order in terms of chronology. But we did Witty and Witless, which was a baptism of fire for my actors.
why was that?
It's just really hard to get into the mindset of it. In terms of it's just there's no meaningful full stops until the end of a line. A stanza, you know, it just keeps going. It just clause after clause after clause. And it took a long time for the actors to tune in to Heywood, much more so than Partner and the Friar or John, where those plays, there was a much greater sense of the character speaking, whereas there is character in Witty and Witless, but it's subtler, there's less distinction, it's more the debate is the thing.
Mm.
So then we came to Gentleness and Nobility, and they keyed into it very quickly. They were very happy with flowing along, travelling along very nicely. And then the ploughman makes his last speech and exits, and the knight and the merchant come back in, and they couldn't say a line.
Mm.
They just suddenly, it was like they just couldn't get the words out. And it was that point we're going, is this written by someone else? And if you look at the structure of the play, it's that thing, if you compare it with Witty and Witless, the ploughman's exit is the logical end point for the play. You know, you have two halves that are broadly equal then. By and large, people don't make the second half longer than the first if they can help it. Because it's appalling psychology. Because people always just, in their heads, look at their watches going, yeah, well, the first half was this, so the second half must be over by now. So that whole return, and the actors were going, well, this bit's pointless. It doesn't really say anything new.
Mm-hmm. I have a theory about this, but it's fascinating. So keep talking.
Yeah. So the and I say this is an internal theory, and we sort of, I am very, very careful of not necessarily, because we like stories, therefore we like inventing a narrative. It's just the idea that the initial conception of the play was a much more open-ended debate, where the ploughman, because the ploughman's final speech is very much about, well, no one here is going to change anybody else's mind. And it's a quite a nice way of ending the play.
What I say, we see well now by plain experience, when a man is set in a willful credence, all to fortify his own opinion, if God himself then would with him reason, in effect it shall no more avail than with a whip to drive a snail.
And it's almost like someone went, yeah, you know who our audience is, don't you? And yeah, maybe we should have those two back on and just say something else. And it just feels like that was added. When or where or how, I don't know whether that's even a later element, but there's a few little bits before that where the sort of mention that they might come back in again, and it just feels that that's as a dramatist and as actors, we sort of went, it feels odd.
I agree.
And you know, and it's not just that the final epilogue is sort of doesn't fit, it's actually that return has been commissioned separately of the initial piece. I mean, it might still be by Heywood. It doesn't quite read right to the actors, but that doesn't necessarily, you know, if it was written in a hurry, then that's a, you know, or against one's will of the original conception. But, you know, it could be by a different hand, and so that we're quite willing to go with that. But that's all just sort of actually instinct and opinion.
No, but that's so interesting, and it does speak to the value of performance as a means of understanding the plays in a way that simply reading them over and over again can't illuminate. I mean, that instinct, that it just sounds and feels different. I mean, absolutely accords with what I encounter in that play, which is, it seems to make a lot of sense if you read it as a work of 1529. Mm. I mean, it's about humanist social reform, it's about economics, it's about all the things that More and Erasmus were concerned about. Mm. And towards the end, it's about Parliament coming. It's about, you know, people getting together to work out how you can ensure that society works well. And we know that both John Rastall and Thomas More would have been summoned to Parliament over the summer of 1529. And so that seems like a context. You know, it's the first Parliament since 1523. There's a chance to explore the actual practicalities of putting in humanist social reform into practice. But there's that sense of, you know, we know how this is going to end. You know, parliaments are parliaments. People get together, they talk about a lot of highfalutin things, they mend a few bridges, and then they go home. Humanist reform is never going to get beyond the vested interests of the merchant classes and the aristocracy. And that's kind of where it ends, isn't it? I mean, the ploughman says, I'm never going to get these ideas, however self-evidently convincing and morally just they are, past these vested interests, so I'm just going home. And that feels like where the play ends, on a very kind of pessimistic, in the real world, you never get anything. But then, as you say, they come back on again and they show themselves to be complete.
Oh, now by my truth, I am glad that Carter is gone.
So am I, by sweet St. John. Oh. I heard not a churl this 7 years show such cursed reasons as he hath done here for the maintenance of his opinion. Yet he is deceived for all his reason. For it is necessary that rulers be to have possessions to maintain their degree.
You know, their heads are in the sand, they're never going to reform. Mm. And then the philosopher comes on and says, John, just a minute. Mm. Actually, you can counsel those in power. You can worry them and frighten them and prompt them morally as moral agents to act in the world. And it changes the whole dynamic, you know, from being pessimistic, nothing is ever going to change. For the first time in Heywood's entire dramatic career, a play ends with the idea that something can change. You haven't gone back to where you started. And I think what the most interesting possibility is that is added either by Rastall in order to print the play, or by the two of them together in order to perform it again or perform it for the first time in the period right at the end of the summer of 1529, when Thomas More was actually appointed completely surprisingly as Lord Chancellor. You know, we know that when Wolsey was dismissed, there was a lot of debate on who would be the next Chancellor. And they couldn't work it out. And the council argued for days about who it would be. And then suddenly they said, oh, well, we'll have Thomas More. And so I think that would have kind of energized that circle in which Heywood and Rastall and More were working and writing. You know, it completely changed the dynamic. You know, he was going to be Lord Chancellor. He could actually put into practice some of the things that they'd always dreamed about. So I wonder whether that's the reason, the prompt for changing the play and thinking, well, actually, let's use this as a kind of energizing piece of theatre rather than one that just says, yeah, we all know what's going to happen with this one.
Yeah, the play ends and then it doesn't, and then it doesn't again. And that maybe that's a deliberate dramatic act. And that's an interesting thought.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that, you know, this is not a play that was leading us to believe a philosopher would come on at the end.
No, no.
And tell us what's going to happen. It's a merry play between a gentleman, a merchant, and a ploughman. That's how it's sold.
Yes.
And then suddenly there's a fourth character who speaks. And the detail, I think, is suggestive as well, because you have a sudden introduction of a discussion about what you do with ministers and councillors who've lasted too long and become embedded in the system and become corrupt and are part of the problem, which was never discussed in the whole of the rest of the play. But if you're talking about who succeeds Cardinal Wolsey after 15 years as Chancellor, then that's suddenly quite a timely issue. And all the stuff about, well, let's make tenure for offices like this temporary, and let's give people property for the duration of their holding of the office rather than as a kind of inherited wealth.
And such people are virtuous conditions, and no other should be chosen governors. And they should have lands to maintain their honours term of their lives as long as they take pain for the Commonwealth.
That all makes sense if you're suddenly thinking, well, how do we prevent another Cardinal Wolsey? And if Thomas More is going to be the new Cardinal Wolsey, it suddenly becomes very kind of pertinent to him as well. You know, how are you going to be different? How are you going to make sure you don't become, you know, the old corrupt minister after a few years? And that's very humanist. I mean, that's very utopian in the sense that, you know, it doesn't even trust its own instincts.
And it speaks to the sort of different projects that come to mind in terms of trying to make these live for a modern audience. My approach so far has been to try and find some kind of modern connection, even if it's tenuous, if only for the actors. But in performance of going, well, how can we communicate some of that? Can we find a way whereby the actual context of the time can be communicated so that it relates? And all of that sort of detail, which I haven't engaged in because in my medium it's actually very difficult. That's the problem with the audio universe, is that it's that kind of context, which in a live staging I might be able to find a way of if not all of that, but maybe communicate something. It's much more pertinent with something like Witty and Witless, where the context of just someone called Will Summer, which we had no opportunity of explaining, you know, who he is. But actually in a live context, you know, we could have someone be Will Summer in the room watching the play, and which is not an entirely unplausible scenario in terms of Witty and Witless feels very much like a response, very pertinent response to his existence. As that, you know, was he written exactly because he had arrived at and was about.
With sharp nails, some nib him. Not even Master Summer, the king's grace is full, but taste of sometimes some nips of new school.
And that was a debate that sort of emerged, and then they would engage in a more detailed application.
Or was it rewritten
the point
when he arrived?
Yes.
I mean, as a pertinent hook on which to make this suddenly more interesting again.
Because he's, you know, it's that context of the putative first performance. Though with Witty and Witless, who knows? You know, it's
It wasn't. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about writing about this drama from this period. I mean, that it's very often the case that you don't know whether there was a performance beyond the first performance. They're very ephemeral things that just happen to have been printed afterwards and gain a kind of afterlife they may not have had before. And that's very much an accident, I think, of Heywood the playwright being brother-in-law and son-in-law to printers.
Yes.
And a printer who was experimenting with the idea that you might actually be able to print drama for the first time in England.
Where would we be without the Restalls?
Yeah, exactly.
Because, you know, pretty much everything from that sort of 50-year wodge of history, if we didn't have the John or William, we would be screwed.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you can sort of imagine them thinking, well, you know, I've got this thing. Will anyone buy it? Will anyone read it? How do I describe it? Well, it's a kind of dialogue. It's a kind of interlude, but it's got jokes in it. Well, just say that. Say that on the cover, and then they'll buy it. You know, it's a debate between three people with some diverse toys and jests added for your amusement.
Just while we're still on Witty and Witless and Gentleness and Nobility, do we know of any performance history in a relatively modern times?
Because I would have said, you know, there is no modern performance history, but then you kind of keep finding these little things. I mean, we gamely said that the production of Weather that we did at Hampton Court was the first one since the 1530s. And then we realised that Iris Murdoch had taken a tour with Oxford students of the play of the Weather around the home counties in about 1956 or something.
Yes.
So, I mean, who knows?
No, I mean, that's the thing. I keep asking if anyone knows of any Witty and Witless. I assume a student production or some
probably.
Something.
I mean, there must have been.
I don't.
You hoped.
What I don't understand is why there aren't more, just full stop, just simply because the casts are small and they're not very long. It's perfect for fringe theatre.
But also, in a way, it doesn't look like medieval drama, does it? I mean, if you think medieval drama is all about devils and Christ or farting and or polemic, then it's not really any of those things. It's that blurring with dialogue, I think. And I think that's very much the case of, you know, Heywood was brought up in that humanist circle around the Inns of Court and around Thomas More. And so he sees a play as something quite different. He doesn't come at it from a performative angle so much as a dialogic angle. So he's quite happy to entertain a group of people who are used to arguing. Formally, I mean, the Inns of Court, you know, you had the moots where they kind of practiced arguing in court cases with each other on hypothetical cases, and the whole kind of grammar school education by arguing and by imagining scenarios. And he uses that because he knows that most of the male members of his family, at least, are used to that kind of thing. So his plays are full of references about, you know, how you argue and what a good argument looks like and what a bad argument looks like. And I think, you know, that doesn't exist anymore. You can't.
I really like in Gentleness and Nobility the fact that the, I mean, it's sort of annoying it's used twice, but when physical violence is used the second time, the knight and the merchant can turn around and say, well, if you resort simply to attacking us physically, if you've effectively lost your argument because you're failing to argue, which is a very good point, I think, in modern discourse about, you know, if you attack the person rather than the argument.
Oh, and if he can no colour of such thing find, then will he vex and chaff in his mind, and cast out some lewd words of quarrelling, to turn the whole matter to chiding and fighting. And so dost thou now, like one that were mad.
You know, it's a very literal interpretation of it.
Yes, yes. Ad hominem with a stick, a small whip. Yes.
But learning that skill to actually argue the point rather than argue the person is a really, I think, quite a pertinent point about modern discourse and how we discuss. I think we should.
I mean, there's also that great moment where he, is it the knight who quotes the Bible and the ploughman just says, cheating, you know, that's it. You're like someone who just reaches for the Bible as soon as you run out of logic.
That shall I prove by good authority. For read in the Bible, and thou shalt therein see.
Yes, and not
which
only
is a wonderful kind of indicator of the culture it comes from.
And not only that, then quotes some Latin back at him.
Yeah.
And just going, yes, oddly enough, actually, I've been around a little while, and just because I'm a ploughman, it doesn't mean automatically mean I'm an idiot or uneducated on some level.
Mm. Well, you know, we've agreed to argue by reason, and the Bible isn't reason.
Mm.
And I think, you know, the audience would be saying, yes, we know that. Mm. We learned that at school, didn't we? Yes.
Yes.
if we're only doing classical argument today, then we mustn't cheat.
Mm. But then we've got, after Witty and Witless, or approximately after, I mean, they're all sort of tumbling on top of each other, aren't they? But we've got Sir John and great title, which is obviously an adaptation in a quite explicit a sense. And any thoughts about that one as a text? Because it's in many ways it's the most fun play to do, but it's also the most problematic for a modern audience, because there's nothing like someone coming on stage at the beginning and saying, should I beat my wife or not? As an opening gambit, it doesn't sell well to a modern audience.
No.
Godspeed, your masters, everyone. Woke ye not whither my wife is gone? I pray God the devil take her. For all that I do, I cannot make her, but she will go a-gadding about, hither and thither. But by our lady, I woke not whither. But by Gog's blood, were she come home, and to this, my house, by our lady of Crome, I would beat her, or that I drink.
But I mean, I think, do you not say this, he said airily, on one of the podcasts, that it's only funny if we are aware quite early on that he can never beat his wife?
I think we had that discussion with the actors.
And I think that must be it. But, yeah. And, you know, this is obviously written in a time when beating your wife was a normal thing to do. And so that's very hard to get back to culturally and mentally.
Mm.
But, Hayward is still, to some extent, at least within that broad context, on the side of the angels, in that his husband is pathetic.
Hmm.
It's that kind of henpecked, inadequate patriarch that we're laughing at, rather than Tib, who is actually more vicious and unpleasant than the wife in the French original. So, I mean, they're both pretty loathsome, which makes it his least congenial play in many ways, because in all his other plays, apart from perhaps The Pardoner and The Friar, you have characters who are sort of trying to make the best of things, or at least one or two that you can kind of invest your sense of humanity in. Whereas in John, they're all unpleasant and vicious and
or weak. I mean, it's the weakness of John is he's just such a pathetic figure.
Right. I mean, but part of the it's a difficult one to do as a sound play, I think, because part of the humour must be his constantly chafing the candles.
Oh yes,
sitting in the corner,
masturbating
in
the corner.
And you have to be aware
of
that. Yes,
I mean, it is. You hand an actor a cylindrical object and tell him to chafe it. It's beautifully obscene. He's over there eating her pie. You know, the symbology of it all is brilliant.
Sit down, good Sir John. You require... Husband, I say, chafe the wax by the fire. While that we sup, Sir John and I.
And how now? What will ye do with the pie? Shall I not eat thereof a morsel?
Go and chafe the wax while thou art well.
And you're right, it doesn't come across. And, you know, in the sense, I'd like to do it as a live show. But then as a live show, it's almost, you need the audience on sides, and so you end up in this sort of circular universe for me.
But I mean, I think I suspect this was one of the first plays that Heywood wrote. I mean, partly because it's, you know, he's learning from another playwright. It's a translation. And you can almost kind of imagine Rastel saying, look, I've got this bundle of French plays. See if you can turn one of those into something we can put on in Finsbury Field. But I mean, even then, the very small adaptations and changes that he makes are indicative of the playwright he will become. I mean, there are those moments when he does have John talk to the audience and sort of divide them up. I mean, that moment when he says, if I beat her, it's going to be rough. I don't want you to intervene. You won't want to see that. And of course he doesn't. And then he says, well, beat her. Ah, says he. Ah, Corda. What if she should die? And then he says, oh, good point. You know, what if that happens?
But what, and she thereof die? Then I may chance to be hanged shortly. And when I have beaten her till she smoke, and given her many a hundred stroke, think ye that she will amend yet? Nay, by our lady, the devil speed wit. Therefore, I will not beat her at all.
And he's sort of talking to different parts of the audience and saying, well, what should I do? What do you think? What do you think? Which is not there in the French version.
No.
And this is Heywood, I think, realising that in real time, with a real audience of people you actually know and can anticipate the reactions of, you can blur that distinction between I'm a character on stage and I'm the person you know. Mm. And you can get conversations going that make for a kind of dynamic theatre.
I mean, that's why that and Pardon the Friar feel very connected, in the sense that the theatricality of the event is so apparent. I mean, Pardon the Friar, in many ways I was relatively happy with our audio version, but it doesn't exist outside of theatre. You can't actually adapt it, because it's a game between performer and audience, or the two performers and audience, as to where your attention sits.
Yeah.
And ultimately, anything I produce is curated. I'm nudging the audience to listen to one side or the other ever so slightly. Yeah. And that then changes how the performers perform, because if everyone's looking at the partner, then the friar will change what he's doing to make the audience look back at him. And in that sense, I've argued this, and I will stick with this, it's the most theatrical play I've ever come across, in the sense that it can only really exist in a theatrical context.
And it's the more you look at it, the more brilliant it is, because I mean, it's not just two people shouting.
No.
I mean, it has those moments when it clearly envisages there being two rival appeals to the audience at the same, literally at the same time. So, you know, there's repetition in there. So you get the idea when the friar keeps talking about the Bible. He says in scripture about four or five times.
And we friars,
exactly. Yeah. Yes.
This is the pardon that we travail and labour in our...
We friars take pain for the love of our Saviour.
All manner of trespass. This is the pardon of which all mercy doth bring.
To every Christian nation.
This is the pardon.
But I say, thou partner, thou wilt keep silence soon.
So you can get that, even if you're not watching him. So he's clearly anticipating an audience with a choice or a conflict of attention. And then there are the other moments when they kind of come together.
Yes.
And there's a debate. And then you go back to cacophony or rival demands. And he's built that in. And at the same time, you have this ambivalent friar who is on, you know, he sounds at the beginning like Chaucer's friar, you know, corrupt and wheedling. And then he sounds a bit convincing and you think, oh, well, maybe I've got him wrong. And then he sounds radical and Protestant and you think, oh, goodness, what's going on here? And then he ends up corrupt after all. Mm. And you know, Heywood's clearly sort of teasing the audience about, you know, what is this guy? Who is he? What is he doing? And again, that's very late 1520s, you know, when there do appear to be reforming radical preachers who people are not sure about.
He does throw in, and it's something that throws in almost all of the plays, is that a checking of of your sympathies. If you're going too far with one person, he'll throw in something to make you go with another person's thought, yeah. Or they'll just take the edge off. There's something in Gentleness and Nobility which touches on this.
There's a brilliant moment. You may be thinking about this moment when the merchant has that wonderful speech about artificers and how the world would not be what it is without the noble miller and the noble weaver and these people. And you're thinking, gosh, what a wonderful statement for the kind of artisan and his dignity, and these corrupt aristocrats are simply living off the backs of these people. And, one nil to the merchant. But then, just as you think that, the knight comes back and says, yeah, but merchants are corrupt and it's only justices that keep them honest. Mm. And actually, the things I've done in the past are just as significant. And he allows them to kind of ebb and flow. And then, of course, when you just think that, oh, okay, I know where this debate is going, on comes the ploughman and says, well, actually, you're both pillars of the establishment and neither of you have done anything in your whole lives that's any worth.
And authority.
Now, here is bibble-bubble, clitter-clatter. I've never heard of so foolish a matter, but by God's body, to speak the truth, I'm better than either of you both.
And it's a similar trick done better, I think, than in Witty and Witless, in the sense that the debate is won between John and James, and then suddenly Jerome, and I'm going to stand by that, it steps up from the audience rather than from some mythical, some other place, because it's the kind of coup de théâtre that that Hayward would go for, that he just stands up and says, no, you're wrong. Yes. You were right first time.
That better be a fool than a wise man, sure.
Not so. Although your fancy do so surmise, not better for man to be witless than wise, nor so good to be witless as witty nother. Thus is your wit deceived in other.
Why?
What? And just starts the game again. The disadvantage with Witty and Witless is that James just buggers off straight away, just goes, oh no, I'm you know, unless he remains silent, which he so can't. He just goes, no, he's obviously going to win. Whereas John's an obvious mark. We sort of worked on the assumption that John was just not very good at debating.
Yeah.
He might be right,
I mean, this is...
but he's not very good.
Yeah, well, he the classic own goal of saying, I want my children to have a fool for a father is kind of, oops.
I give up my part and take your part plainly. Of witty and witless, I wish no rather that my child may have a fool to his father.
And then, of course, Jerome has to stand up in the role of the tutor and say, let me just talk you through this again.
Yeah.
You should have said this and this and this, and then you had that chance and you didn't do it. And it is absolutely a play growing out of those grammar school education classes in how to argue and use rhetoric and become a civic citizen by learning how to debate, I think. So in a way, here's an interesting question. They don't ever identify themselves in the course of the play, do they? James never calls James James, and John never calls James.
And I kind of feel that that's reflective of actually who they are, is that John is...
Yeah.
you've got two people who potentially could be called John in the cast, but you can't call them...
No.
James is as close to John as you're going to get. So, and it's almost like... And then you've... go with Jerome because it has a sympathy with what he's saying.
And I think that's probably the result of printing it, or rather of writing it down.
Yeah.
It wasn't printed, was it? We've got to call them something.
Yeah.
It's like you and one, two, three, and four.
You are John, so we'll call John John, and you're also John, so we'll call you James.
Yep.
That's my little universe, is that it's John Hayward, John Restall, and someone else.
Yeah.
Have all got together to put on that play, and whether it happens.
But I mean, that goes
is...
back, doesn't it, to Fulgens and Lucrece, which Moore may have played in.
Yes,
where you've got two characters called A and B, who are just obviously playing themselves, and the idea that people in a play can be playing themselves is kind of inherited from that concept drawn into all of Hayward's plays.
And it's similar in the sense that we can't be 100% certain, but I'm pretty much 100% certain that that Witty and Witless starts with them just wandering in. They're already mid-argument.
Yep.
And it's the same sort of thing in Fulgence and Lucrece, where they're mid-flow and they walk into the room at a time when theatrical convention was, well, you're in a room. You're not.
Yeah.
Sometimes
enter the players.
You just want. You wander in and start, and you've got to find a way of starting. You've got to find a way of ending. Without...
Get them on and get them off.
Yeah. Yes.
Which, again, is 4P, isn't it? When the Palmer comes on and says, oh, hello. Who are you then? Why am I here?
Yes.
As you see, I've just been to Jerusalem, and here I am.
Look at me. Look at me. Yes, let me just list all the wonderful places I've been to. Aren't I a great person?
Yeah.
I'm a palmer, as ye see, which of my life much part have spent in many a fair and far country, as pilgrims do of good intent. At Jerusalem have I been before Christ's blessed sepulchre. The Mount of Calvary have I seen, a holy place, you may be sure. To Jehoshaphat and Olivet on foot, God wot, I went right there.
Exactly. I mean, what they call that in the Croxton play of the Sacrament, making your boast, which is a great kind of, come on and make your boast.
There was another thing in Gentleness and Nobility I particularly liked, is the way that the knight manoeuvres the ploughman into dispraising the merchant. It's the way that the knight is trying to manoeuvre the situation so that he can win without actually having to say anything himself. If he turns the other two people against each other, then he almost by default wins, which is very clever.
That's, again, very, very typical of a Heywood play. It's that sense of how you can win a debate, either by being best or by just getting the other two to implode or something. So, you know, there's that moment when, Witty and Witless again, where I can never remember which one of them it is, but he says, well, your argument's not bad, but it's wrong, and I'm going to show you how it's wrong, but I'm going to do it gently.
Oh, yes, stair by stair.
Yes, let you down step by step to the point where you concede I was right all along.
Yeah.
To set ye down featly, stair after stair. And so, by a fair figure of induction, to bring your part soft and fair to destruction.
And it's just, you know, they want to win. And that's, Heywood must assume that his audience take that as the end point of the plays. You know, this is not, you know, enter, marry, fall in love, be eaten by a dragon, come back and everything's all right. The plot is, who's going
to
win?
Yes, I say to the actors, these aren't debate plays, these are argument plays. They're having an argument and they want to win. Which is why the interjections are actually almost as important in our recordings as the actual lines written down. So there's a sense of, look, you're going to retort at some point with your next line. Mm. At what point do you know that you're coming back with that? At what point do you start going, no, hang on, which isn't obviously there on the script, but if the play is to be alive, you've got to have that. And obviously we do it orally, but also if in live performance. And when we get to Play of Love, where there's such a one, I'm reading at the moment the vice character, the doesn't love and loves nobody.
Oh, no lover nor loved.
Yes, miserable bastard, him, as he's otherwise known. His deliberate goading of the lover who is loved, and the actor playing him, and I'm just sitting in the corner, and it's just throwing the lines to him quite casually, just going, "Oh right," and he just wants to curl up and just kill me, because it's just like he does this one long beautiful speech about, and like, just goes, "Oh really?
Of all mine affairs in thought, word, and deed, love is the Christ cross that must be my speed."
By this I perceive well, ye make reckoning that love is a goodly and a good thing.
Love good?
it's just, I'm not even going to dig, and he just gets so wound up. And it's such beautiful gameplay. And I think this is why the actors absolutely love these plays, by and large.
But they have to get their eye in, don't they? I mean, once you see that, then it's fine. And that was how it was with the play of The Weather. You know, most of our actors had done Shakespeare, but hadn't done anything earlier. And they began by thinking, oh, I don't really get the rhythm of this. I don't really get why I'm saying this. And then suddenly they did. Mm. And that it was, you know, that was a wonderful moment of kind of liberation and realization. And what Gregory Thompson, the director for the Hampton Court Weather, did was, you know, he said, you mustn't add dialogue. Mm. You mustn't add anything to the text. Well, obviously, he did occasionally, but that was fine. But what he had them do was occasionally repeat the last line of the person's argument as a kind of mocking.
Yeah.
You know, you did that. Mm. And, you know, as that kind of moment you were describing, you know, at what point do they see that they can come back at what this guy's saying? And so they would do it by kind of mockingly repeating the last line or two of what the other guy had said, and then said, well, you know, 0 out of 10 for that one.
Well, and actually,
I've got a much better argument.
They do tend to be quite well structured in the sense that you would have a long speech going through bit by bit the argument, but then quite a lot of the time you will have a two-line précis at the end, which does help. And I think in terms of keeping the audience with you helps, because it is sometimes very knotty for a modern ear. I mean, this is the thing. I know the actors, once they get into it, love it. What I don't know yet, and we'll discover soon, is how well it plays to an audience that's listening, and, you know, how well we can get away with what we do. You know, 4Ps, we're doing the stories from, because they're good, fun stories, and we can sort of physically act them out. But that's a really interesting sort of shaggy dog story kind of play. Because the debate isn't really, it's not really a debate play in the same way as the others are in that sense. It's more open-ended. It's more it's more demonstrative about character doing things and demonstrating who they are. And so it's much looser, and it's slightly harder to get a grip on as a play.
But it goes all very baggy and very interesting in the middle.
I mean, it takes a long way to warm up. It takes a long time to warm up, we found.
And there's that wonderful moment when they all just sort of look at each other and say, well, what do we do now?
Yes.
I mean, the peddler's just come on and said, so you don't want to buy anything then? Like, nope.
Yeah, that's, it was shut down so quickly as well. Everybody else gets a couple of pages on their particular line of work, and the peddler just, he gets about a 15-line speech or something.
Yep. Gloves, pins, combs, glasses, unspotted. Pomades, hooks, and laces knotted, brooches, rings, and all manner of beads, laces, round and flat, for women's heads, needles, threads, thimbles, shears, all such knacks. Where lovers be, no such things like...
And that's it.
That's it. Yeah.
And that's it.
But I'll stay around, he says, hopefully, if you can tell me what we might do. Let's sing a song. Yes. Oh, that wasn't very good.
Yeah. In a sense, it's the same gameplay of the sense of finding those little moments to do something to wake the audience up, as it were. You know, so you've got the bit
they've got to be invested, I think. I mean, it's they don't work unless you actually care who wins.
Yes.
Doesn't matter who you care who wins, but you need to care somebody wins, I think. Otherwise, there's no point. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, 4Ps is the trickiest one I've found in terms of... Normally when I do one, I can sit there and go, I can see how I would do this if I was doing it as a live show.
Mm.
And 4Ps is the one that I struggled with the most. It didn't immediately leap out at me.
Right.
Whereas it's the most, probably the one of the most well known. It certainly has one of the better publishing histories.
Yeah.
It's the most listened to so far.
And most mentioned by Shakespeare as well. In that there's one reference.
So, well, I don't know. I think Play of the Weather, the relationship between Jupiter and Merry Report is so Midsummer Night's Dream it hurts.
I mean, I think Hayward. Yes, I think Shakespeare knew his Hayward.
But, yes.
I mean, he actually name checks 4P and in Thomas More. So it's, you know, bizarrely, I don't know why, but there it is.
Well, I suppose it's logical to mention Hayward in relationship to Thomas More in some shape or form, doesn't it?
Yeah, there was clearly a memory of him being to do with Moore in some ways. I mean, clearly that was ancient history. And, you know, most of his media career, as it were, was as Hayward the epigrammatist.
Yes.
You know, that's how Johnson and people remembered him.
Yes.
Not as a theatre man at all, which is revealing, I guess.
Mm.
You know, as you say, you know, what we have is his early work.
Yes.
And we don't know whether his later plays were just kind of, did he do a revival of 4P for Queen Mary or... Did he write another play? It's frustrating that we don't really know.
No, you know, we've got this little fragment of reason, secondhand. Mm. Still sounds actually quite like him, I have to say.
It's classic Hayward, isn't it?
Yeah, it read very well.
And the difference between man the commander and beasts being by man commanded is only reason in man, the discerner of good and ill. The good in man elected by me, and the ill in man by me rejected. Man obeying me shineth in excellency, and disobeying me showeth man's insolency. Now, since I, reason, am the only quality that qualifieth man in such a temperance as setteth man in place of principality above all beasts to stand in governance, who but I over man should himself advance to govern likewise, since I bring man thereto, and keep man therein doing as I bid him do?
You need reason and you need will.
Yes.
They have to live together.
Yes.
Play nicely.
And that was the end of part one of my interview with Professor Greg Walker. Part two will be released in a few weeks' time, hopefully, alongside our production of the play of the weather. All the other plays are available now on the podcast. There is a playlist also available, so you can listen to them all approximately in order, as well as other ancillary information and details. You will have also have heard during this podcast the voices of Geir Madland, Rob Meissen, Hayden McCabe, Simon Nader, and myself, Robert Crichton. What's coming up? Well, we're trying to keep a fairly tight release schedule of 2 to 3 things a week at the moment. A recording of an exploring workshop where our irregulars read through a play that you've possibly never seen or heard before, a prologue or speech from a play, and then something else, something usually a little larger and fiddlier to produce, like a discussing episode or a full cast play or scene. This, as usual, is not set in stone, and remember, we're also putting up new material on our Patreon page first. This month, we're hoping to get out the bulk of our John Heywood material and also to release a whole host of stuff about John Bale because, well, he's John Bale. I'd like to thank Professor Greg Walker for speaking with me and for you for listening. This has been the Beyond Shakespeare podcast. You can support us by going to www.patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, or you can just follow us on Twitter @BeyondShakespeare.